Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We'll talk about where this economy is headed, of course, that's our job, and the global one in which we participate. Also, a little bit later on, shoes from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday today, the 26th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody, with an eye toward the part of this program that is about context and why what is happening is happening. We begin today with some of the cross currents swirling around in this economy right now. The pandemic, of course, a relief bill or not, the labor market and jobs, and what, in a very macro sense, the prescriptions to fix that have been from the people whose job it is to fix that. We talked about it a little bit last Friday with Heather Long from The Washington Post.
There's been a sea change in Washington. Trump was part of it. So was the Federal Reserve, and believing that we should run the economy hot.
So running the economy hot means that we're pushing up against the boundaries of what we call full employment. Running a hot economy means people have jobs.
That's Mark Pauly, teaches economics at New College in Florida.
The people who benefit most from a hot economy are folks at the low end of the wage distribution.
Which sounds like the direction one would want to be headed, and in fact is what Fed Chair Jay Powell says all the time. However, comma.
The concern is that that good economic environment for the individuals comes at a cost in terms of higher inflation.
Tara Sinclair teaches economics at George Washington University. The thing is, that worry about inflation just isn't happening. Even as hot as this economy was running before the pandemic, with unemployment last January at a relatively microscopic 3.6%, no inflation to speak of at all. So
we've learned that we can have potentially a much lower unemployment rate than what people had thought would bring on inflation.
Which is why running the economy hot is kind of a change in perspective. Jay Powell, I'm sure, will talk about that idea, if not use the actual words, tomorrow as he wraps up the Fed's two-day meeting. Another perspective, this time on the global economy, is that next year is going to be better than this year. The International Monetary Fund came out with its global forecast this morning. The IMF figures 5.5% planetary economic growth in 2021, up just a bit from their estimate this past October, which struck me as I read it as optimistic, to which the IMF's chief economist, Geeta Gopinath, when I talked to her this morning, said, maybe not exactly.
So, Kai, I'm not sure I would say this is an optimistic forecast.
Okay.
We have a small upgrade of 0.3 percentage points. But that said, yes, there is tremendous uncertainty because we have a mutating virus and we are in this race with vaccinations.
On the idea of fiscal stimulus, I don't want to get you bogged down in American politics, easy though that may be to do. But it's pretty clear the president's $1.9 trillion plan is not going to go through as he certainly would intend. You talk here about worries that governments might move to austerity as they start thinking about how much money they're spending. What's your trepidation level there?
I mean, our view is that we are still in the midst of this pandemic. So there is a need to provide effective and targeted support to struggling households and businesses, and also, in the case of the U.S., also to have more spending on rolling out the vaccinations at a much faster pace than what we're seeing right now. So this is needed, and it has to be done in a targeted manner.
Well, but yeah, the question, though, is what happens if that doesn't happen?
Well, again, the details of this package are being worked out, and my hope is that some of it will happen.
Some of it. Okay, we'll go with that. Let me turn to monetary policy. As you know, the U.S. Federal Reserve is meeting today and tomorrow. They are going to hold interest rates where they have been, which is bargain basement low. Other central banks are doing the same thing. And you are banking on central banks, pun I suppose not really intended, keeping interest rates extremely low through the duration of this forecast.
Yeah, we expect central banks to keep interest rates low for a while. I mean, the question is, what are the risks associated with that? Is there a risk of inflation? The way we see it, inflation expectations are quite well anchored. But then there is, of course, the financial risks that could be building up. And we've been making the call for a lot more attention to that.
Explain that a little bit for the people listening.
Well, what we are seeing, we've seen fairly exuberant financial conditions somewhat disconnected from the real economy, that there is some overvaluation in assets, and that's something to pay close attention to.
You know, elsewhere in the program today, we're talking about something that seems to be happening in a lot of countries, right? That economies are being allowed to run hot. That is to say, lots of fiscal stimulus, really low interest rates, because inflation is not a worry. I wonder what your take is on that, because it's a change, right? It used to be that you let an economy run hot and everybody said, oh, my goodness, terrible things are going to happen. And now it's kind of like, eh.
Yes, I think some things were learned over the last decade. I mean, we had U.S. unemployment rate go to 3.5%, which was, you know, a decade low, and still did not see much inflation pressure. You know, we still have labor market slack. That, including what we would describe as, you know, inflation expectations, which is a very important piece of this, is what makes one expect inflation to stay within around over the target.
Yeah, and inflation expectations right now are extremely low. Last question, and then I'll let you go, Dr. Gopinath. If we come to you in 6 months, and I guess this is an entirely subjective question, but what's your sense of how you're going to be feeling about the global economy?
Well, I hope that in these 6 months, we would have much greater success in ending this health crisis, much faster success, through much more accelerated rollout of vaccinations, not just in the countries that have gotten vaccines right now, but in poorer nations also. And if we do that, then I think we could come in 6 months to a point where the world economy is recovering strongly and on a more stable footing.
You know, I lied. This is actually the last question. I say on this program all the time, the virus is the economy for this country, certainly. Is it fair to say that for the global economy, too?
Absolutely. I think that is right now very much the case.
Dr. Geeta Gopinath, she's the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, out today with their economic outlook. Dr. Gopinath, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street on this Tuesday, more down than up. Again, though, not a whole lot of enthusiasm. The strange calm, perhaps, has extended to the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know that old saying, as California goes, so goes the nation? In virus lockdown news, where California's going is kind of muddled. Governor Gavin Newsom has lifted a statewide stay-at-home order, which means restaurants are going to be able to reopen, but only for outdoor seating. And the rules are going to vary from county to county, virtually all of which, counties that is, are still in the critical or widespread outbreak categories. But restaurants out here, as Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports, are ready to go.
In California, outdoor dining has been shut down since early December, when Governor Gavin Newsom issued a statewide stay-at-home order. It's gotten criticism from the restaurant industry. And Xing owns Bajoli, a French eatery in Santa Monica whose butter-poached lobster has earned rave reviews.
I definitely understand the public health need, but at the same time, it really felt like restaurants were specifically being targeted.
She says she's waiting to hear the specifics of the new guidelines.
I think that'll be very telling into whether or not it's actually going to work for some of us to be open.
The California Restaurant Association says 30% of restaurants in the state are expected to go out of business in this pandemic. Greg Morena is with the association. He spent last night and today rushing to prepare his restaurant, the Albright in Santa Monica, which claims world-famous clam chowder, to reopen. Among other things, he had to call his staff and find out.
First and foremost, who's available? Some people have found other jobs. Some people have moved out of state.
Morena says he hopes to reopen by early February. Not all restaurant owners are this excited. With Southern California still in the grip of COVID-19, many wonder how long the reopening will last. Lynn Ta already lost one of her restaurants, here's Looking at You, to the pandemic. She still has another, All Day Baby, with its beloved biscuit sandwiches. When it comes to reopening outdoors, she says,
we're all exhausted, and it's difficult to make these kinds of decisions when, you know, we don't even learn about them ahead of time.
So for now, she's going to put a few tables outside for self-service. She's not getting her hopes up just yet. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
The headline story about parents in this pandemic, by which I mean mostly women, is that more than a million of them have left the labor force because their kids are in school at home, and making that work is not compatible with work. But there is another layer or two to this story. Gallup, the polling people, they say only 47% of parents whose kids are in school from home are working full-time. 71% of parents, meanwhile, who are able to work full-time, have their kids back in brick-and-mortar schools. Marketplace's Erica Barris takes a look at that workforce divide.
Before the pandemic, Lara Smith worked
really, really, really full-time.
She regularly clocked 50 and 60-hour work weeks as a litigator in San Diego. Then came March, so she went part-time to help her 11-year-old son with his remote schooling.
It just had to happen because all of a sudden I had a kid at home.
Smith's employer has been understanding, but that's not always the case, says Joan Williams. She runs the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings. She says switching to part-time work is often harder on women.
Typically, they pay through the teeth for it.
First, they're earning lower wages. And second, they can face judgment when they try to come back full-time. But Beth Humbard, management professor at UMass Lowell, says the pandemic may do away with that.
Folks that have a 6 to 9 to 12, 18 month break during this period on their resume, I don't think they're going to have to do as much explaining as before.
Even so, some workers aren't taking the risk. Wendy Woodford in Rye, New York, has a third grader in hybrid school and doesn't want to leave her part-time job as a financial analyst.
I want to not lose that momentum I had so as she gets older, I can start looking for another job with more hours.
But when caretakers try to go back to full-time work, their earning power has sunk, according to Vasu Reddy with the National Partnership for Women and Families.
Largely because a number of employers base their salaries that they offer on what you made in a prior job.
And that can mean less retirement money later. Lara Smith in San Diego knows this, and she's already dipped into the family nest egg.
When this is done, there's going to be some time rebuilding that for sure.
And that can only happen when she goes back to work full time. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the belly flat business is very slow right now.
The shoe business getting by on a shoestring budget. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 22 points today, basically flat percentage-wise, 30,937. The NASDAQ down 9 points, also essentially unchanged, 13,626. The S&P 500 down 5 points. That's about a 10th percent on that index, 38 and 49. As you heard from Jasmine Garst, some restaurants are not looking to reopen, sticking instead with takeout. Chain restaurants, mostly counting on takeout. Chipotle, up almost a 10th percent. Potbelly Sandwich Shop gained 1.25% today. An internet outage froze screens across the Northeast today. Verizon support reported via Twitter. A fiber was cut in Brooklyn. Not clear if that was the problem, but Verizon shares down 3.1% on the day. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.03%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The American Bankers Association says people are paying their credit cards on time more. Delinquencies in credit card payments hit their lowest ever in the second quarter of last year. That is April through June, which is to say just as the pandemic recession was settling in on us. And get this, delinquencies stayed low in the third quarter as well. Sounds like a good thing. And as Marketplace Justin Ho reports, yeah, maybe.
The report found that credit card delinquencies fell in part because people used government relief aid to pay off their bills. Rob Strand is senior economist with the American Bankers Association. He says it also helped that credit card balances were already falling.
Consumers have become much more careful about their spending.
According to the New York Federal Reserve, that trend started at the beginning of 2020. Tim Quinlan is senior economist with Wells Fargo.
That is what you kind of want to see in the context of a healthy consumer sector.
Thing is, Quinlan says we shouldn't get too excited when fewer people are delinquent on their credit card bills. That's because credit card balances are a relatively small part of overall household debt.
It's the smallest overall category, much smaller than mortgages and a little bit smaller than auto loans and even student loans.
And the people paying off their bills last year don't represent the entire economy, says Teresa Ghilarducci, an economist at the New School.
Having debt on your credit card is a middle-class phenomena.
Ghilarducci says people with high incomes tend to have low balances. On the other hand,
poor people have a hard time getting access to a credit card, so they're not fully banked.
Ghilarducci says some of the most troubling forms of debt right now are student loans and the debt many renters owe their landlords. The government has deferred those payments for now, but
those arrears are mounting. And so we are seeing a situation where poor people have a lot more accumulated debt that's just been built up.
Ghilarducci says in the long run, student loans and rent will be much bigger hurdles than the country's credit card debt. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There you are, early in the morning, wondering what's going on in business, in the economy. Might I recommend the Marketplace Morning Report? Check it out. There's a whole slew of economic indicators this week. The IMF outlook, of course, which we talked about up at the top of the program. Also, though, a report on fourth quarter gross domestic product. That is the size of this economy. The year's first Fed meeting tomorrow and whatever Chair Jay Powell has to say. So alongside all the formal insights we are getting, we thought it might be a good idea to get some of our regulars back on the line to tell us what they are buying and the prices they are buying stuff at.
Hi, this is Sudipto Chatterjee from the San Francisco Bay Area. Ever since the pandemic started, my wife and I only went to the grocery store together once a week or so. Then the holiday surges hit the Bay Area, so we signed up for Instacart for the first time ever. Interestingly, the price of items that you can get from the big box stores like Walmart or Costco are the same on Instacart as you would get on their website or in the store. But the smaller stores, like the local Indian grocery store that is listed on Instacart, has its prices marked up just a little bit on the platform. Now that we are into it, we might just stick with online grocery shopping until most people are vaccinated, or at least until the many different strains from the UK, Brazil, or South Africa are under control.
This is Ellen Murphy in Mission Hills, Kansas. When I go to my geriatric shopping hour, I take a list and I try to add things that I can buy that are usually on sale, and I donate them to the food pantry bin. I feel like it would be nice if there were a way we could donate perishables, because right now is a good time to be getting citrus and fresh greens. It would be nice if families could get groceries and make their own food as opposed to getting food that's ready-made.
This is David Romer from Denver, Colorado again. Looking at prices of things, food is getting more and more expensive again. Really no surprise there. Going to restaurants, the ones that are open, it's just so much more expensive than it used to be. And airfare is back to the way it used to be as well. There's no more half-empty plane discounted tickets. Every ticket I've been looking at is about the same, if not more, than it was pre-pandemic.
That was Sudipta Chatterjee up in the San Francisco Bay Area, Ellen Murphy in Mission Hills, Kansas, and David Romer in Denver. David mentioned air travel, by the way. Yesterday, the TSA screened 701,000 passengers. A year ago yesterday, just a touch over 2 million people. A lot of us, most of us, I would guess, are living really different lives than we lived before the pandemic, in a lot of ways, too, big and small. And that's manifesting across the economy, including in how we shop. Case in point, with so many people staying home in slippers or socks or maybe barefoot, I don't know, shoe sales are way off. And as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, changes in consumer behavior like that play out in the economy and in neighborhoods.
I'm at this shoe store in Brooklyn the other day when I see a display of black leather ballet flats. And they kind of stop me in my tracks. The store is called Sola, and the owner, Rick Lee, is showing me around when we come upon the flats. They're the kind women used to wear to the office. Perfectly appropriate, moderately uncomfortable, a mainstay of business casual.
I'm looking at these shoes, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to be buying anything like that anytime until I have to go back to the office.
Yeah, the ballet flat business is very slow right now.
So I ask him, how long has he had these?
Basically, since the beginning of COVID.
The store's sales are down 60% year over year.
There's less of a need for people to dress up, go to work.
Or go anywhere, really. And even people who might like to buy new shoes can't necessarily afford them right now.
It's very tenuous.
And not just for shoe sellers. There's a shoe repair shop right across the street. When I walk in, the owner, Joseph Davidoff, is standing behind a glass case filled with brushes and polish. The wall is lined with ticking clocks. He fixes those, too.
I used to open up shop at 8 a.m., and people used to wait in front of my shop. And I used to be upset at myself, like I'm a minute late or 5 minutes late, and there's two people waiting. Now, between 8 a.m. and 9 a.m., there's nobody.
His sales are down by 70%.
One of the reasons I'm able to survive, my landlord has reduced the rent.
They know each other. He's been a tenant there for 10 years. And he says his landlord probably doesn't want the shop to sit empty. Half a mile away, in an empty hotel lobby in downtown Brooklyn, two empty chairs sit on a platform, surrounded by rags and shoe polish. This is where I find Marco Orozco. He's been shining shoes for more than 20 years and says before the pandemic, these chairs were filled all week.
Here in the hotel, we was a lot of parties, weddings, all that stuff, so the people likes to be nice and shiny.
And he got a lot of business from the lawyers and government employees who work across the street at courthouses and city buildings that are quiet now. So all day, Orozco sits and waits.
I'm coming just in case. Sometimes I don't do anything. Sometimes, like, you know, I get like maybe one or two customers in the day.
He says he doesn't have to pay rent right now. The hotel's giving him a break until business picks up. But he has other bills, so he may have to shut down and find other work. Everything's up in the air. And that's one of the hardest things about this crisis. Brooklyn Running Company is a shoe store in Williamsburg. Inside, it's very Brooklyn hip, with a red brick wall and rustic wooden shelves that display running shoes. Kate Reese is the general manager.
I just don't know what the future holds. I don't know how long this is going to last.
Reese says the problem is, in the shoe business, you have to lock in orders many months ahead of time.
All my orders through basically December of 2021 are in, and I lose so much sleep over that.
Because it's not clear what sales will look like this year. Her customers buy different shoes if they're about to run a race. Will the New York City Marathon happen in November? Who knows?
You know, we want to have really fun options and lots of options when people come in to get fitted, but I am careful to make sure that I don't have way too many shoes sitting in the back and no dollars to pay staff or to pay electricity or pay rent.
She's had to make her bets for the rest of the year, not knowing when the virus will be under control. It's another way that businesses like hers could be feeling the effects of the pandemic even after it's over. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Mariel covers retail for us, as part of which she does a series of profiles called How We Shop, on the theory that what we buy and how we buy it says something about us and our lives. So do us a favor, would you tell us how you shop and whether it has changed in this pandemic? We'll have a link at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, media news. Larry Kudlow, formerly of CNBC and then the Trump White House, where he was the director of the National Economic Council, he has found his post-politics perch. Fox Business announced today he is going to host a new daily program for them starting later this year. He is also going to be on Fox Business and Fox News as an on-air financial analyst starting February the 8th. Mr. Kudlow, of course, is also the economic advisor who said of the virus in February that, quote, we have contained this, I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight. Holy cow, we got to go. Tried to cram too much in here today, so you got to find your own moment of economic context, gang. Sorry about that. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mematolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.